I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. We're continuing our series, The Book That Changed My Life, and today takes us into the middle-class New Orleans suburb of Gentilly with the model citizen, Binks Bowling. Now, for those not familiar with the Walker Percy novel, The Moviegoer, Binks is the character who explains early on that, and I'm quoting him here, "Once I thought of going into law or medicine or even pure science, I even dreamed of doing something great. But there is much to be said for giving up such grand ambitions and living the most ordinary life imaginable, a life without the old longings. Selling stocks and bonds and mutual funds, quitting work at 5 o'clock like everyone else, having a girl and perhaps one day settling down. It is not a bad life at all." Our guide into the world of Walker Percy's The Moviegoer is the Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Richard Ford. Richard is, of course, the author of such books as Independence Day and The Sports Writer. We'd like to have you join us as well. Are you an admirer of The Moviegoer and of Walker Percy? Well, it's interesting to note that both Walker Percy and Richard Ford reject the tendency to categorize writers by region. Percy's originally from Alabama and Ford's from Mississippi. They shared common ground in New Orleans, but neither one has much use for the label Southern writer. Do you favor fiction that goes beyond these kinds of regional categories, or do you find yourself drawn to a literary work because it is set in or speaks of a particular place? And a reminder that our question for this week remains the same. Is there a book that changed your life? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Time now to welcome, from a studio in Augusta, Maine, the Northern writer, Richard Ford. Hi, Richard.
Well said. Well said, Dick. Thank you. That was a very nice lead into it. I couldn't have said any of those things better myself.
It's nice to have you back on the program.
It's a treat for me. Thank you. It's a nice, typically sunny, warm day in New England.
The Moviegoer. Tell me why the book's so important to you.
Well, some odd synchronicities, I think. I read it in New Orleans just as I was about to turn 30. It's like reading Herzog in Chicago. It's set in New Orleans, as you said when you were talking about it. Why it's important to me? Well, it's on the most obvious level, it's a wonderfully pleasurable book to read. For me personally, it is set in the South, where I'm from, but it somehow manages to be set in the South and to make the South be like any other place, which was terrifically important to me. It also, in Percy's instance, brought, I thought, his best intelligence and his best instincts and his best grasp on the language to bear in a very accessible book that was utterly convincing, which is probably what most of us want to do who are novelists. So it also was an affirming book, or tried very much to be an affirming book. It also talked about how it is we live on Earth with Earth's compromises and pleasures, which were all things I thought I knew something about or had an instinct for, but hadn't yet quite found a language for.
And I think it's a daring writer that chooses to go down that path of putting those, you know, existential puzzlings down on the page in a language that's accessible and allows us to connect our own lives to that same kind of musing, you know?
But it's the daring all of us want to somehow find a way to perform, to enact. When you're a young writer, you struggle a lot, it seems to me, with the formal properties of novels and your own rather inconsistent understanding of what you're good at. And what you'd like to do is to master the formal properties of a novel and find a way to get what you're good at onto the page. And that's what Percy did.
I want to go back to how you began your answer here, that you were just around 30 yourself when you read the book in New Orleans, because it is precisely at that turning of the page in Binks Bowling's life, from entering his 31st year, his 30th birthday, where Walker Percy introduces us to him. And at one point, Richard, he uses the word, it comes late in the book, so maybe it's not a particularly apt way of looking at the worldview of Binks Bowling, but he uses the words dark pilgrimage. You know,
right.
Here I am, my dark pilgrimage. Is he a pessimist about life?
Well, no, I don't think he is a pessimist about life. On the other hand, he is a man trying to be affirming about life from the point of view of someone who suffers from time to time with a failure to be affirming. I mean, I think a book is renewing as we want literature to be, when it shows a character trying to find a vocabulary for affirmation, trying to find the institutions in life that will let him like life better and be better at it. So you could take the dark side of that, I suppose, and there is a certain seriousness in this book that can't be overlooked, and it is sometimes a little bleak. On the other hand, it is headed toward the light.
I'm wondering if I can ask you to read a page from the book. Do you have that section where he's talking about his new Dodge sedan there?
Yes, I do. It's on page 121.
Now you selected this as a kind of a way in on both Walker Percy and the moviegoer. What do you want us to be paying attention to when you read this one?
Well, just like any other novelist, all I want you to do is read to the end, and then you can think, and then you can think whatever you'd like to think. If I'm very good at what I'm doing, and Percy is very good at what he's doing, everything that is to be made available to you will become available to you. But I would say this, though. I think one of the things I haven't stressed about it is it's a very funny book. It's very funny about everyday commonplace events, mm-hmm. and longings and life and sex and desire and cars and work and business. And so you should get a little bit of that out of this. The car itself is all important, I have discovered. When I first moved to Gentilly, I bought a new Dodge sedan, a Red Ram 6. It was a comfortable, conservative, and economical two-door sedan, just the thing it seemed to me for a young Gentilly businessman. When I first slid under the wheel to drive it, it seemed that everything was in order. Here I was, a healthy young man, a veteran with all his papers in order, a U.S. citizen driving a very good car. All these things were true enough. Yet, on my first trip to the Gulf Coast with Marcia, I discovered to my dismay that my fine new Dodge was a regular incubator of malaise. Though it was comfortable enough, though it ran like a clock, that we were spinning along in perfect comfort and with a perfect view of the scenery like the American couple in the Dodge ad, the malaise quickly became suffocating. We sat frozen in a gelid amiability. Our cheeks ached with smiling. Either would have died for the other. In despair, I put my hand under her dress, but even such a homely little gesture as that was received with the same fearful politeness. I longed to stop the car and bang my head against the curb. We were free, moreover, to do that or anything else, but instead on we rushed, a little vortex of despair moving through the world like the steel eye of a hurricane. As it turned out, I should have stopped and banged my head. For Marcia and I returned to New Orleans defeated by the malaise. It was weeks before we ventured out again.
That's Richard.
I just wanted to say, any time you can say, our cheeks ached with smiling, that's a book I want to read.
I like the frozen in a gelid amiability, because I didn't know what gelid mean, and I don't even want to look it up because it's such a perfect word.
I don't think I've ever seen it in another novel.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a great example of the humor, but it reminds me of my experience reading the book, and I'm sure you've read it more than once, so you might be able to help me with this. But it's one of those books where, as you read through it, and I mean the plot doesn't—it's not one of these adventure stories where you've got to really know what happens in the next chapter. You're trying to understand the characters and figure out how they connect to each other, and looking at how the narrative will advance that way. But the further you get into it, Richard, the more you feel like you've dropped stitches behind you, and you have to want to go back and read that part again because you think you'll understand a little bit better where you're going. Do you know what I'm saying?
Oh, I certainly do. It's for me, it's like reading Chekhov, that every time I pick the book up and start it again, I find something that I had either forgotten or something I hadn't noticed the first time around. I mean, Percy's plot device, so to speak, is to write really good sentences. If he can keep you in the sentences, if he can make words that he has a great relish for make you have that relish, then I think he feels like he's on firm ground getting you to the end of the book.
Now, you knew the man as well. You had a personal relationship with
Percy?
Yes,
I did. Yes,
was he a friend? Would you count him as a close friend when he was still
with us? Well, he was an older writer who was very generous to a younger writer is what he was. And so to say, was he a friend? No, he wasn't a friend. On the other hand, every time I would go to New Orleans, I would just I would just intuitively call him, and I would say, I'm in the French Quarter, I'm thinking about buying a house here. And he would always say to me, oh, Richard, don't buy a house in the French Quarter. Don't buy a house uptown. Come over here to St. Tammany Parish and buy a house in the suburbs, where he lived in Covington. He was good in that way. He sort of entertained my little musings and wanderings without ever becoming my great friend. He was, in a way, a private kind of man. He was an estimating man. When I met him the first time in City Park in 1886.
Could happen in New Orleans.
It could happen, and you wouldn't even know it.
That's right.
When I met him, Nancy Lemon introduced me to him. I could tell he was a man who estimated you when he met you.
What, by the way he looked at you?
Yeah, he gave you I keep using that word, estimating. That's how I felt I was being looked at, but not in a disrespectful way, not in a way to sort of so to say size me up less than I was, but to size me up as I was.
Well, he was a grown-up when he started writing, too. That's another part of the story. I mean, there's a real maturity in what he writes, no?
Absolutely. I mean, he was a physician. He had lived a lot of life by the time he came to New Orleans and was working on the moviegoer through the 50s. He had become a physician. He bounced out of the medical profession because he got ill. He had converted to Catholicism. He had a lot of spiritual life by the time he got around to 1960 and was putting that book into the world.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Richard Ford is my guest this hour, the author of The Sports Writer, Independence Day. He's working on a third in that series, The Lay of the Land. We'll talk about that near the end of the program, because we want to concentrate for the balance of the hour on Walker Percy and The Moviegoer, a book that Richard has selected as a book that changed his life. We'd like to know if you have some relationship with this book, with this writer, or if there's one that changed your life you'd like to contribute. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. We're continuing our series, The Book That Changed My Life. And this hour, we're talking about The Moviegoer by Walker Percy. Richard Ford is our guest. You're welcome to join us at 1-800-423-8255. Now, Richard Binks calls himself a moviegoer and refers to that several times through the book. He and Kate have this kind of private, Kate's his companion, later girlfriend, and so on. But they have this language about movies that makes me wonder if early on they see them as more real than the life that they're leading.
Well, I don't think, even though Walker Percy called this book The Moviegoer, I don't think you can boil that down very much, as you wouldn't be able to in any good novel, and this is a great novel. I mean, the moviegoer is a condition that I think Binks endures or experiences, which has a lot of parts to it, and I think the novel itself is probably the only essential reconciling gesture to all of those parts. I mean, I can enumerate what some of those parts are. One is, of course, that he is a romantic, and he is a person who suffers bouts of abstraction. Mm-hmm. He's a person who looks outside himself for certain kinds of pleasures and satisfactions. He is at the same time, however, and this is one of the novel's great feats, it manages to reconcile those impulses in Binks with what is basically an essentialist nature in the man. Here's a man who really wants to believe in old standard institutional values of business and making money and marriage and doing the right thing and making a contribution, except the malaise works into his life. And to treat the malaise, he goes to the movies.
There's a great moment late in the book when Binks is on a bus coming back to New Orleans, and he meets this young man who is, coincidentally, a romantic, described as a romantic. And Binks says of him, he's a moviegoer, though, of course, he does not go to the movies.
That's it. Which I think is the tip off to the book, that you don't have to be, you don't have to go to the movies to be a moviegoer. You have to be in that condition of seeking, and which is really what is the largest plot device of this movie. This is a man who is in pursuit of something.
We're going to take a call from Atlanta, Georgia. Robert is joining us on the line. Hello, Robert.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Are you a fan of The Moviegoer?
I'm a huge fan of The Moviegoer and a huge fan of Walker Percy. The Moviegoer was my introduction to Percy and the first of his books that I read. And when I read it, it was like I had found myself or had found my own voice, or I just identified so much with the character that I read through all of, you know, the Percy that was written at the time. It was before his death, and sort of followed him after that very much. And even I went to his memorial service in New York, which was a huge, moving event.
What was it about either the writing or the character or the way he tells a story, Robert, that somehow worked for you? Can you be any more precise?
Yeah, I think it was certainly a combination. I mean, the fact that, as you say, that his sentences were so beautiful and affecting and interesting and funny. There's so much in all of his books that's so ironic and so funny that I'd find myself laughing out loud, and the characters were like people that I had known. I grew up in the South. I grew up in Memphis, and so many of the people were like people that I knew or I had known, but I was always like the Percy characters who was in this world but had this kind of interior life that looked at everything from sort of outside. You know, it was this strange kind of existential predicament that I always felt in the same kind of weird Southern situation, and so everything just resonated for me.
Do you think of the book as a Southern book or of Percy as a Southern writer? I mean, you just talked about the Southern perspective there.
Well, I think, you know, that was a way in for me because I was Southern, but no, I think that Percy deals with universal themes about life and meaning and about search. And so in that way, I think he's such a large literary figure in the 20th century. I mean, he really dealt with kind of big, universal, eternal themes in a funny, ironic, you know, Southern way.
Richard, I want to hear from you as you're listening to Robert describe this.
Well, I, of course, agree with everything he says. I'm happy to know that he sounds younger than me, but then everybody does. It makes me pleased to know that the book persists in other generations' lives. I mean, its ironies are gentle ironies. Its ironies are not used against anybody. They're ironies used to make us really redirect our vision back to ourselves in an affirming and gentle way. The other thing that should be said about the book, and I think this is consonant with what Robert was saying, is it's a book told in the first person with present tense verbs, which is no small feat on the one hand, and on the other hand, it creates Binks as a reflective character in a way that probably none of us is quite as reflective a character as he is. But at the same time, morally, what it reminds us is that we can be. It reminds us that we can, in fact, take responsibility for the chaos that's going on in our brains and make something out of it.
I'm just curious why you made the point that it's written in the present tense and in the first person. Is that because as a writer that's a hard thing to do?
It's just not a conventional thing to do. Conventionally, novels told in the first person are told in retrospect. That is to say, it's by a character older, looking back on a time in life with the sort of virtues of that time gone by, so that you can see that earlier time better. This novel is told more or less, although you could argue with it, and I think interestingly argue with it, it's told more or less as it happens. In real time, as they say.
I wonder, first of all, thanks to Robert for that call.
Indeed.
Let's open the book again. This is a second reading that we want to have. And I was going to have you read it a little bit later, but you've just done such a nice job of talking about why it's important to hear someone speaking in the first person and in the present tense. This does that for us, and it's probably a good time to hear it.
This is a particularly wonderful piece of business here. It's just Binks being alone. I awake with a start at 3 o'clock, put on a raincoat, and go outside for a breath of air. The squall line has passed over. Elysian Fields is dripping and still, but there is a commotion of winds high in the air where the cool, heavy front has shouldered up the last of the fretful ocean air. The wind veers around to the north and blows away the storm until the moon swims high, moored like a kite and darting against the fleeing shreds and ragtags of cloud. I sit in the shelter outside Mrs. Schexnader's chain-link fence, opposite the school it is used by those children who catch buses toward the lake. The streetlight casts a blue-black shadow. Across the boulevard, at the catacorner of Elysian Fields and Bons Enfants, is a vacant lot chest-high in last summer's weeds. Some weeks ago, the idea came to me of buying the lot and building a service station. It is for sale, I learned, for $20,000. What with the windfall from Mr. Sartalamacchia, it becomes possible to think seriously of the notion. It is easy to visualize the little tile cube of a building with its far-flung porches, its apron of silky concrete, and revolving on high the immaculate bivalve, glowing in every inch of its pretty styrene. I have already approached the shell distributor. I want to read any book, Dick, which can refer to the shell sign as the immaculate bivalve. And something else that's worth noticing, too, which is in the third paragraph, and I'll just read it again. He says, Bink says, I sit in the shelter outside Mrs. Schexnader's chain-link fence, S-S-S-S-S, all those sibilants that go on in that sentence. Now, I know our poet friends would like to say that we novelists, ham-handed as we are, don't pay attention to such things as that, but we do. We just don't make a fetish out of it.
1-800-423-8255 to our callers now. To Cambridge, Massachusetts, Alexandra is joining us. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, thank you.
Good morning.
Well, I wanted to just say that I read it when I was 19, and I felt like it gave me permission to see my own quirky way of observing and kind of accept myself, because I remember there's a line where Percy talks about gum that's stuck under a counter or under a chair in a theater or something, and that he remembers this kind of detail when he forgets very important things. And when I was 19, I was aware that I was really sort of a spaced-out person and that I didn't do very well in school, and that in a lot of ways I was kind of just out of it. But I was actually an artist, and I was observing a lot, and Percy showed me that you could make these kinds of observations and that they might seem unimportant, but to an artist it really sort of critical. And actually, Richard, I've read a lot of your writing, and I remember there's one book you wrote, and I don't remember, classically, I don't remember the name of the book. But
I might remember.
Well, you're renting a house, and you're in a kid's bunk room, and you're writing from a child's bedroom. You're staying in some house, and there's like a colored bunk bed. It's kind of it's where you were actually doing your writing from one of your books.
Yes. Yeah.
And it was that kind of observation that I'm a painter and a writer, but I'm always observing things that may seem really unimportant, but they're kind of critical to me, and it's what I'm really interested in. And Percy just had a way of making that important, you know, just being able to observe.
Well, and knowing what to observe, you know, because you see it all, but what do you zero in on? What do you pick, Richard? I don't know how you, you know, but that's got to be a large part of the man's talent, right?
Well, Henry James said, the terrible whole of art is free selection. If we knew how we did it, we wouldn't need people to do it. We could all do it. I mean, it's in some ways it's luck. I'm not much for talent, but I think talent is a species of vigor, and so Percy was very vigorous in both his belief in the artistic gesture and very vigorous in how he took his attention to the page every day. I would just like to say something back to Alexandra, which is thank you for saying those things, and so much for the male novel told by men about men having no reference outside of its own small little province. You know, if literature is the supreme means by which we undergo a renewal of sensuous and emotional life and learn a new awareness, then really it should be transgender, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it is transgender. I mean, I don't, you know, I never...
No, I know.
No,
thank
it's
you.
Absolutely. It's just, I mean, all artists, that's why, you know, there's no gender when it comes to making art, really.
You know, Alexandra, when you were describing the parallels between your own sort of 19-year-old perspective and what it is that Binks describes, one of the things that I think he does with tremendous skill is... Percy has Binks become somewhat vacant in in dealing with some of the other characters, particularly early on in the book with the Aunt Emily, who, you know, will dominate every conversation, or you know, and all those older people who want to teach him what he should be or tell him how to live his life. Do you know what I mean? He's got this sort of ability to go blank when that happens.
Well, absolutely. He goes blank, and then he feels sort of guilty because he seems to remember things like gum under a seat more than something somebody tried to teach him. But I think it's just that he you know, he was just sort of getting interested in what he was interested in. He was sort of thinking, I'm interested in observing and looking at, you know, light on a window and somebody walking by, and that was just how he, you know, that was the artist in him. He wanted to, he was observing constantly.
Go ahead, Richard.
Sort of, yeah, anyway.
I was just going to, excuse me.
I'm just going to say that that's really one of the advantages of the first-person present tense, that when Binks isn't necessarily saying anything, and when he's narrating what his Aunt Emily or his Uncle Jules or Mercer is saying to him, it's a dramatic silence. It's not an inert silence at all, given how the book is narrated.
1-800-423-8255. Next to Washington, D.C., Paul's on the line. Hello, Paul.
Yes, hello?
Yeah, Paul, you're with us. What do you think? Are you a fan of the moviegoer or Walker Percy?
Well, I'm a huge fan of both, and I appreciate the opportunity to call. I'm in Washington. I could only hear the program when I called in. A friend of mine, knowing my love for the book, notified me, so I've called in. Richard Ford is your guest,
yes,
right?
Indeed, he is.
And I believe Richard is from Jackson, Mississippi, originally.
That's true.
And I grew up in Yazoo City.
Well, we all have our burdens to bear, Paul.
Exactly. So I grew up in the Mississippi Delta. I was a junior in college at Mississippi State, struggling quite a bit with how to learn a vocation and have artistic sensibilities. Discovered a profile of Walker Percy in The New Yorker by Robert Coles. Immediately ran to the library and got The Moviegoer and read it, and it has just been a treasure and sort of a beautiful piece of music for me ever since. It led me to read everything that Percy wrote. It led me to many books written and published by the same publisher at the time, which Knopf had published The Moviegoer. I began to subscribe to The New Yorker as a result, and have read every New Yorker for the last 25 years as a result of that. And the same with Harper's Magazine after The Second Coming was excerpted in Harper's.
Which is another of Percy's novels.
Yeah.
Percy led me in so many directions.
I'm going to put you down in the category of people who are influenced by Walker Percy. I think that would be fair, Paul.
Well, one last comment. I have four children, and my second-born son is named Walker Percy. Named Walker Hatchet. So I wanted to name my first-born son after Walker, but my wife insisted on Peter for my first son, but the second one was Walker. It turned out that twin was born 3 months before Walker Percy died, and he turned out to be left-handed. I had twins. The one I named Walker turned out to be left-handed, and so is Walker Percy.
This is, Richard, a fan club that I didn't know existed until this hour.
You just lift the corner of that rock, and we all come scuttling out. I mean, it's just, it's just that kind of book, Dick. Really, it has a huge, it's a huge admiring fan constituency. But it's sort of like it's a little bit like any other fascinating book that hasn't become a brand name. It becomes a kind of a secret handshake among its admirers, a little bit like Revolutionary Road by Dick Yates. It's just one of those very, very special books.
How many times would you say that you've read it then, Richard?
Oh, well, I don't read it cover to cover.
Yeah.
Maybe cover to cover I've only read it a couple of times. I sort of just read around in it periodically when I want what it's got. And it rewards irrespective of where you open it. Just as we've been doing reading these passages, you don't really have to have much of a setup. You just sort of immerse yourself in the sentences, and it starts giving you all of its joys.
Connection listeners, do you go to The Moviegoer to get what it's got? We're at 1-800-423-8255. In our ongoing series, The Book That Changed My Life, Walker Percy, it appears, has quite a remarkable fan base right across the country, and we're interested in exploring that a little bit further with your assistance at 1-800-423-TALK. Richard Ford is my guest. He, of course, is the author of The Sports Writer and Independence Day, for which he won a Pulitzer Prize. And we're here right after the break, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection this hour in our ongoing series, The Book That Changed My Life. It's The Movie Gore by Walker Percy. Richard Ford is my guest, and we're going to New Orleans. And a call from Bob. Hello, Bob.
Good morning, Richard, and I'm happy to call in. I love this show. Good morning. I don't want to move the subject too far away, but the book that changed my life was a Walker Percy book, The Night of the Hunter. I was a 13-year-old kid in Franklinton, Louisiana, going to a segregated library, which was about 300 feet and probably had no more than 1,000 volumes in it. And that book not only scared the pants off me, but it made the connection for me between the tensions of good versus evil, helped me to understand the purity of innocence, and really introduced me to an appreciation of narrative and of dialogue.
Well, that's a pretty impressive list of accomplishments for one book. Richard, do you know this one as well?
I don't. I'm sorry to say.
In a nutshell, Bob, is it a horror story?
The Night of the Hunter is a story of a man who had been imprisoned and as a result of a robbery and had hidden the money from the robbery in the neck of the doll of his daughter, who was at that time about a six-year-old girl. And after having gotten out of prison, this ostensible preacher went on a crusade to track down his ex-wife and the two children. There was also a young boy who was a part of that family, and to get back the money that was stowed in the neck of this doll.
Was he a likable character, this person?
He was an evil character. He was a man who hid behind the cloth as a so-called minister after having gotten out of prison, but he was evil personified.
Why am I not surprised, Richard, that Walker Percy would put a collar backwards on someone so evil as a way of telling a story?
Well, Dick, there may be more than one Walker Percy in the world, is all I can tell you. Just like there might be more than one Richard Ford.
Okay.
I think that the Walker Percy that I know and who wrote the movie Gore was not the Walker Percy who wrote the novel that this caller is describing.
All right. Well, Bob, I will thank you for that call. And, you know, the one thing that we haven't got to, and I've got little circles and arrows and stars on the piece of paper that I scribble on in front of me, Richard, is this the Southern thing, which is we've not gone straight at here. You said that reading this Walker Percy gave you some kind of permission not to be trapped in, you know, the quote marks of a Southern writer. What exactly did you mean by that?
You know, that's something that your caller Alexandra said when she said that when she read it at age 19 that it made her feel a sense of permission. I mean, that's what we want novels to do, to create a need for more life in some ways, a more feeling, bring you closer to the world. I had grown up in Mississippi, you know, around Faulkner and around Eudora Welty, and they had pretty well described the South for me and basically made the South on their pages be a great deal more than the South was even to live it. But when I read Percy, here was Percy writing about a South that I suppose I could have seen, but was entirely a South he took new command of. Mm. It was the South of uptown New Orleans. It was not about history. It was not about the intransigencies of race. It was not about place itself, but it was really putting place behind the characters and making the book be about what characters did. So for me, that was very important to get outside the grip of those other writers and to be told that that a writer such as Percy could take a new grasp on a subject. I mean, I didn't want to write about the South after I had written one novel about it, and yet I wasn't sure that there was anything that I could write about other than the South. And somehow to read Percy let me know that maybe my intelligence was going to be adequate to extend to something that wasn't Southern. So for me, reading The Moviegoer, albeit a novel set in New Orleans, I think as your character said before, or whether your caller said before, not so typically Southern, manumitted me to go out and write about New Jersey, to write about Montana. Influence is expressed sometimes quite subtly.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is that in order to give you or anyone that kind of permission, then it's not that he avoids it, but he's particularly good at writing about the South. In fact, so good that he makes it a story that could be anywhere. It's not like I'm not drawn into the neighborhood of Gentilly or the Gulf Coast or the beaches or, you know, the Smith family vacation home. He takes me very much to those places, but they're not in any way confining, I guess.
No, and that's well said. I mean, you could live in Boston and find yourself the scion of an old family and feeling somewhat distracted and in malaise and not quite sure how to get yourself attached to life as lived. And that's what The Moviegoer is about.
We're all on that search of something, for something, which is one of the things Binks goes back to in the book. Our number's 1-800-423-8255 to Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Linda's joining us. Hi, Linda.
Hello. How are you?
Good morning.
Wonderful program. Richard, so glad to hear your voice again. We have met. And I just wanted to say that the person who talked from Louisiana, Bob, I guess, about something about the Night of the Hunter, I have edited a Walker Percy bibliography, and our Walker Percy did not write that book. So
no, he didn't.
Richard is right
about
that. But one thing I wanted
to say. You know this man's writing pretty well, then.
Oh, yeah. I wrote my dissertation on him, and then I have published two books on Walker Percy. So I moved to New Orleans in 79, and 4 months later I met Walker Percy and was in his lunch group with a lot of wonderful people. He had two lunch groups, his friends, his age, and we were his younger friends, but we're not very young anymore, you know. But what a wonderful writer he was. And I think I'm kind of bouncing off the caller from Cambridge, the young woman who said she noticed a vacancy, you know, with how he dealt with certain characters like Aunt Emily, who was very didactic in preaching to Binks about what he ought to be, he should go to medical school and whatnot. And I was thinking that kind of didacticism is a kind of thing that Walker talked about when he was ridiculing another character in his next book, The Last Gentleman, from 1966. He said that she was theorish, T-H-E-O-R-I-S-H, and by that he's really talking against the Cartesian idea of the mind being supreme over the world. Walker Percy thought it was really important to get away from theories, from didacticism, from stoicism, and back into the world. And
and this is important because the man was extraordinarily well-read. I mean, he read philosophy texts.
Yeah, his library, a lot of his books are at the UNC Library, at the Wilson Library now in the Southern Historical Collection.
Let me ask you a quick question, if I can, Linda. What's the one little pearl of wisdom that you take from that lunch bunch, the writing skill of Walker Percy?
Well, I think to listen and to wait. He always talked about how Kafka had in this huge sign above his desk in Czechoslovakia, and in red and white, written a huge sign, and it was Warte, W-A-R-T-E, which in German meant wait. It means wait. And Walker said that was one of the most used words in the Bible, not happiness, not you weren't promised happiness, but that you needed to think about waiting. And then something would happen. Something would come to you. And part of waiting is listening. And I know that
And observing as well, too.
Pardon?
I said and observing as well, too.
Well, right. And see, that's part of it, the waiting. Walker said that, I think it's in The Last Gentleman again, where the goal of Will Barrett was to have a girlfriend that you could sit on a park bench in Central Park and share a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and never even have to talk, so that you were just silent and waiting and observing and being in the world with this person, not having to talk, which in a sense is a kind of theorizing, trying to make a point.
I'm wondering if I can swing this back to Richard, because if I look at Richard, I think of the writing of yours that I've read, you have that same kind of observer's eye, and I'm wondering if you would say that Percy taught you something about, you know, being patient, being that observer, not having a character that necessarily has to be leading every conversation or every narrative event.
Well, in the passage that I read, the passage that starts, "The squall line has passed over, Elysian fields is dripping in steel, but there is a commotion of winds high in the air." Nothing's ostensibly going on there. Binks is just basically describing what the weather is, but he's doing it in language, and language is a repository for values which novels put into action. And so what might seem to be timeless waiting is in fact in novelistic terms an opportunity to notice language, an opportunity which all realistic novels are trying to get you to do anyway, but also an opportunity to take responsibility for your moments.
1-800-423-8255. We're going next to Alston, Massachusetts. David's joining us. Hi, David.
Hello.
Good morning.
Hi. I was calling because The Moviegoer was a book that I was introduced to by a young woman named Katie, and at the time I wasn't sure if my exaggerated intellectual self-regard would allow me to continue to do that, but then she told me her favorite book was The Moviegoer, and I realized that if that was true, she could probably put up with me. Also, The Night of the Hunter is by Davis Grubb, not by Walker Thompson.
Oh, bless you.
Don't you love the listeners to this program? They probably know with a year that it's published as well. So, David, The Moviegoer is... you were how old when you read it the first time? Any recollection?
I was probably 30.
Which places you in the same place that Richard was at, reading it at the moment of the man was writing it, or the character writes.
Uncomfortably close to that, yeah.
I think it's meant to be kind of uncomfortably close, Richard, isn't it? Aren't all those things that we thought we'd be when we grow up and end up not being?
It's very acute in its observations about life as lived moment to moment. You bet it is. It is meant to be both uncomfortably close and to provide some consolation in language for that very discomfort, which is to say it's a novel about the frustrations as one tries to renew oneself, which when you read it becomes itself a renewing experience. So it doesn't prey on its dissatisfactions, and it doesn't prey on the malaise, but it certainly does treat you to it as a way of getting you then out of it.
He talks Binks, but I guess Walker Percy talks in the book about repetition being something that is important. I'm wondering if you have some insight on that, because I think I may have missed exactly what he was trying to tell me with the importance of repeating an experience to, well, I don't know what, Richard, make
well,
it real?
Well, I could actually read that passage for you if you'd like me to.
I'd love to, dude. Can you get it that
yes,
quickly?
Yes, I can.
Wow.
What is a repetition? A repetition is the reenactment of past experience toward the end of isolating the time segment which has lapsed in order that it, the lapsed time, can be savored of itself and without the usual adulteration of events that clog time like peanuts in brittle.
Wow.
The peanuts in brittle is the last.
That's the payoff.
it has to taste like something, I guess. Well, what I think Binks is doing, and Percy through Binks, is he's doing what Sartre says when he gives the name to something that was otherwise uninflected in us. He brings to our notice something that we might have felt but never could have organized in language that was unique to us. And in doing that, he does what great novels do. He sets the world. He looks at the reader straight on and says, look, at least provisionally, the world is this way. Now, it then foments a kind of a conversation with the reader who says, oh, is it? Oh, gee, I don't think it's that way. And the novel then says felicitously, oh, yes, it is.
But the oh, yes, it is comes so subtly in the way that he writes it, you know, that you never really feel like you're being told anything. And maybe this goes back to discovering the world at the same pace in the present tense with Binks.
I think that has a lot to do with it. And also I think it has to do with what Linda was talking about before, that it's not a polemical book. It may be very smart, but it's always tasting its own peanut brittles. It's always smelling what the air smells like. It's always looking at the sky. It's always noticing the nuance of someone's face as they tell you something that they know you're not going to want to hear. So that's its saving grace. It takes us back to life as realistic fiction should.
And Binks is physically caught in this book between his mother's family, the sort of easygoing common folk, and his aunt's family, which is determined to hold on to a certain sort of class distinction there. And yet, the reason I bring it up is that it follows what you were saying. He doesn't really deliver any judgments there. He doesn't end up by telling us or trying to tell us or being seen to try to tell us that one person's better than another person in the book.
But I think the book actually is lovely for that. I mean, if you think that in fiction, as in most good drama, that drama is good when the villain says something that's interesting, that's what Percy believes intuitively. I mean, Aunt Emily is a representative of a sort of aristocratic, semi-moneyed uptown, rather bunkered-in style of life, Boston Club, cruise and carnival, and I think anybody in New Orleans who reads that, and maybe finally anybody who reads it who's from Boston or who's from Cleveland, understands that aristocracy, with its eye toward history always and its eye toward conservatism always, is finally the thing, the force that frustrates renewal.
But it takes such storyteller's integrity not to tell you that, but just to show you that and let you conclude it on your own.
There is a long speech at the end of this book in which his Aunt Emily basically scourges him,
yeah.
Basically says he's no longer really anybody she recognizes as a member of the family, which in a way frees him to go on and do the things he wants to do. But, you know, you don't have to be beaten over the head to figure that out.
What a great insight into a piece of writing and a writer. Richard, I want to thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, and thank you, and thanks from all of us who are great admirers of this book.
Richard Ford. His books include The Sports Writer, Independence Day, and the forthcoming The Lay of the Land. It will follow that sequence. I said I'd say something more about that, and I ran out of time, so that's all I can say. You're just going to have to wait for that book. You can, in fact, be a part of our forum on the Book That Changed My Life series by going to our website. We're at theconnection.org. Tomorrow we conclude the series with the writer Russell Banks, and we're talking about Jack Kerouac's On the Road. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.